This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily. Today is Friday, March 14th, 2024. On today's episode of the show, we're going to be talking about the new movie Opus, and we'll present an interview with that film's writer and director, Mark Anthony Green. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm an editor at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film staff writer, Bill Bria.
Greetings, Earthlings.
Greetings, Bill. Okay, so let's dive right into this movie. Before we get into some spoilery aspects, I just wanted to know, I'll lead in this way. So did the music in this film work for you? Because John Malkovich plays a pop star who has disappeared for about 30 years, and he makes a grand return. And the whole premise of the movie is he invites a select few group of people to a sort of isolated compound for a listening party for this new album that he's going to be dropping on the world. So I kind of feel like this movie doesn't work unless you really buy that music actually sounds like real pop music that people in our world would listen to and love. So did the music for this movie work for you?
Absolutely, 100%. In fact, I would say that the music in this movie is the number one best thing about it. And it stands to reason that it would be, because these songs are co-written by the likes of Nile Rodgers, the co-founder of Chic, and The Dream, who works on all of Beyoncé's albums. So the film and director, writer Mark Anthony Green went out and used, I assume, his contacts, and I think he might have been friends with these folks beforehand. And if you're going to write fictional pop songs, might as well get people who write pop songs for a living.
Yeah, man, I was a really big fan of especially the song 35 millimeter, I think it's called. They just released a lot of this music on Spotify and YouTube and a bunch of other places, so you can actually go and listen to these songs if you dug the music as much as I did, and I encourage people to do that. I was rocking out to 35 millimeter earlier today. So, what did you think about this movie overall, Bill? Again, before we get into spoilery stuff.
Yeah, but it's a movie that I think shows a lot of promise. It's got a lot of thought behind it. It's got a lot of topics that it wants to tackle. And it's ambitious. And I think that if there's a detriment, and there is, it's the fact that it resembles so many thrillers that we've seen in recent years, which is the... I don't think there's really a name for it or a snappy like term that we've coined yet, even though it feels like we probably should have one. But it's, you know, the Agatha Christie-esque revival of not necessarily a murder mystery, but, you know, eccentric billionaire or eccentric, you know, wealthy person invites a bunch of, you know, random folks to a remote estate, a remote location. Things go awry. They have some sort of agenda, which isn't revealed till later, and so on and so forth. So we've seen that in, you know, obviously the Knives Out movies, because those are direct, you know, Christie homages. We've seen them in obviously the Christie adaptations of Hercule Poirot, that was made by Kenneth Branagh. And then also, of course, stuff like The Menu and Blink Twice. Blink Twice just came out last year. And so I don't think this movie's done any favors by so many similar thrillers coming out in a 5-10 year period. And it definitely, so it has that derivative kind of vibe to it, which in a weird way, and again, we'll get into this when we get into spoilers, but in a weird way, it actually helps the movie in some instances for me, but in others, obviously it's a flaw in the sense that for the first watch, certainly if you are a fan of horror, if you're a fan of, you know, thrillers, if you're a fan of this type of movie already, you'll definitely feel like you've seen it, you know, 5-6 times before, if not many more. And, you know, you might kind of find yourself checking out. And for some people, I think they check out and they don't come back in. And for others, you know, like myself, you check out a little bit and then by the end, you might come back in a big way. So,
okay. Yeah, I agree. You used the word ambitious earlier, and that's my thought about this movie. It's got maybe like a little too ambitious for its own good, which is kind of a good problem to have, you know, like I would much rather, much rather have it be that way than the opposite. But yeah, some of those big ideas you're talking about, I mean, it's about celebrity and like who gets opportunities and why, and the things that we tolerate from greatness. And like, it has all these things sort of swirling around in it. And then there's also the kind of like pulpier, plottier narrative aspect of it that kind of helps propel the story forward. So yeah, I would say I like thought this movie was like pretty good, but I'm really excited to see what Mark Anthony Green does moving forward. I think it was pretty good to okay for me, not like a full slam dunk or anything, but
yeah.
Okay, so I guess let's go ahead and get into spoilers. I just want to like clearly mark this for folks. Actually, before we do that, Bill, would you recommend that people see this movie, or do you think it's skippable? Yeah. Or what? Okay,
it depends on, again, if you're a dyed-in-the-wool genre fan, you watch every horror movie that comes out. Chances are you'll probably give this a shot anyway, because you know if you're rabid enough, then you probably just you know don't you're not as discerning as others. But that might you know it might be a detriment to you because again, like I said, you might sort of look at it and go, oh, I've seen this a million times. And yeah, if you're not naturally inclined to watch this type of movie, I'd say you can certainly skip it. But if there's something about it that intrigues you, whether it's the cast or you know the look of it or certainly the songs, give it a shot, because I do think that there's a chance that you can be rewarded for the experience and not let down.
Yeah. And yeah, you mentioned the cast. Iowa Debri stars in this movie, and I thought she was pretty great. Like she gets put through the ringer in certain ways and has to grapple with where the movie goes, which is a little heightened and maybe a little ridiculous. But I thought she did a good job of sort of holding things down and grounding the story and really serving as that audience surrogate character that that you kind of need for a wacky story like this. So I thought she did a great job. Okay, so now we are full on in spoilers. I did want to ask you, you were mentioning, Bill, that maybe like the derivative nature of the movie kind of helped in a weird way. Can you talk about that a little further?
Sure. And this is made just by my own, you know, weird mind working in its own weird way or the way that I watch films, that sort of thing. But I can definitely recall watching this for the first time at Sundance where it premiered. And about half the way through, I sort of felt like, okay, I get the vibe that we're going for. It feels like we're going for here. It definitely feels like, you know, and given the title Opus and the fact that our antagonist or eccentric wealthy person is this, you know, reclusive pop star who is coming out with new music and has this grand plan for his reemergence into the world, I thought, okay, so this is gonna be something along the lines of, oh, he invited all these randos here to mess with them because he's got beef, which is true. That's essentially is what the part of the case is for bringing these people to his remote, you know, ranch or estate. But I thought, oh, this is all in service of somehow creating some sort of new opus, some sort of new music or, you know, the music of the spheres or the sound of people dying or, you know, the sound of torture, you know, like something highfalutinly kind of, you know, a genre heightened kind of way of like, you know, oh, this eccentric artist has gone off the deep end and now they've decided to record people's screams or something, you know, like, right. And so, you know, I definitely felt like, okay, if this is going to essentially devolve into a more genre space, then, oh, well, it seems like much ado about nothing. What I was really pleasantly surprised about is that the last, I'd say, two-ish scenes of the movie, it feels like that's when Green reveals, you know, throws all the cards on the table. And it clearly was, you know, intended and structured that way because Malkovich's character, Moretti, I think his name is, right? Mm-hmm. Moretti literally lays out to Ariel, Io's character, about, you know, here's why this happened this way and why I wanted you and so on and so forth. And it had the effect of, you know, not as much of a way as, you know, an M. Night Shyamalan movie or even something like Malignant, but it did have a similar effect on me of making me think back through the movie of all those scenes that I was sitting through going, I don't really understand the reason for this other than, oh, it's quirky and weird and he's being quirky and weird, and gave it a context that excited me. And I was like, oh, that feels correct. That feels true, truthful. And it feels engaging now in a way that it didn't before. So it had that double-edged sword of, wow, I'm coming away from the movie feeling invigorated and wanting to talk about it and wanting to debate it and wanting to, you know, dive into the themes and all that, which I did not think I was going to be. I thought I was going to come out, you know, forgetting about it instantly. But I do definitely see the detriment of, if only that could have, some element of that could have been introduced earlier so that on a first watch, you're not thinking, oh, this is just sort of much ado about nothing.
Yeah, totally. I have that same feeling. And when I first walked out of the movie, I was kind of like, I don't know, like the idea that this whole thing was kind of a setup where he invited this aerial journalist character to be there because he knew that she would be capable enough to kind of write a book and like recount what happens here. And then that in turn would spur on the, what are they called? The levelers? Is that the name of the cult?
Yeah.
The levelists. Yes. That would sort of spur them on and kind of like help perpetuate this cult's status throughout the world. And there's that montage at the very end of like, we're everywhere. We're serving you ice cream at your local, you know, ice cream store. We're doing all these little odd jobs. Like we've permeated every aspect of society. Like I was kind of like a little thrown off by that and the way that the movie kind of comes to a complete halt where he is basically like, I am going to do my big villain speech to you now, like mm-hmm. my Bond villain exposition dump. And I was kind of thinking back over the movie and thinking like, well, wait a second. If this was the plan the whole time, like why were these people trying to kill Io's character? Like it seemed like there were several close calls where they easily could have killed her. Like Amber Midthunder's character is kind of like going after her several times. And then as I thought about it more and more, I was like, you know, I guess they did get into that fight in the bathroom upstairs. And there's that scene where the door is closed and the fight is happening. And we learn that Io lost that fight and Amber Midthunder's character let her live. And I guess that's the answer right. for like what happened there. So that's an example of like, I don't know, it kind of felt like the movie wanted to have it both ways a little bit of like, we want you in the moment to feel like she is truly in danger, but later when you think back over it, you're supposed to be like, ah, she was really right. okay the whole time. And it was just kind of like, that's a tough line to walk, especially for a first time filmmaker. And again, with like all these other ideas being juggled by the movie, I don't know if that was fully nailed down for me, at least on first viewing. But yeah, it is a little bit more complicated than it seems at first blush. So,
and that's what I was trying to say too, about if you're already a genre fan, especially horror genre, it's going to be a little bit easier for you to swallow, but at the same token, it's going to feel, you know, like you've seen it before. Because using the Scream franchise alone as an example, there's so many instances in that series of, depending on who's revealed as Ghostface at the end, oh, this person was over here when we thought they were over there, and it's actually this person who did this, and then, you know, all of those contrivances that are really, you know, part and parcel of that series, and they're really fun. But of course, it does require quite a bit of suspension of disbelief to really think through, like, how did they know that all of this was going to happen this way? Because it could have gone that way. Yeah, so it's that sort of, I guess we just have to use that, you know, a suspension of, you know, okay, these people are just so uncannily cunning that they, you know, are able to kind of predict every single person's behavior, even though nobody can do that. But yeah,
I thought the violence in the movie felt a little overly cartoonish to me, almost like it was from another film or something. Like there's that moment where a guy who disappears relatively early in the film, I think it's the first person that disappears from their group, we discover that he's been beheaded and his head is like attached to a wreath that's been hung up on the wall. And then like there's that whole thing with the woman with like the swollen tongue and the I'm not exactly sure what kind of poison she was administered, but like that just kind of felt like it was out of some totally different, more extreme movie than the one that we were watching. But I don't know if you felt the same way about the violence.
No, I did. And I could definitely feel the tension of these kills that are happening. And while they're happening, you know, because going in, we know this is essentially a mystery movie. We know that there's something to be revealed later on. We know that we're not going to get everything, you know, every part of the dastardly plan right up front. So, you know, you're trying to look, you know, this is just naturally, if you're a cinephile, you know, a fan of this genre, your brain's going to be working overtime already, no matter what. So you're looking for clues, you're looking for hints, you're looking for, okay, maybe it was that, maybe it was this. And, you know, there were several points during a lot of the kill sequences where I was like, oh, is this going to be something supernatural, or is this really happening, or are we going for a it was all a dream reveal? Like, you know, sort of stuff where, like, especially when you mentioned the I think the woman has the allergic reaction, right?
And it's
like, well, was that accidental and they didn't really intend for that to happen, or was that absolutely intentional and they did intend for that to happen? They knew this was, and she's in a bag, I believe, or a beanbag chair
or something, right. Which is like such a crazy visual, and like the practicality of that makes no sense, where Io's character was sitting on top of her, but it's a really memorable visual, you know? Like that's I think maybe a good example, a sort of microcosm of what this movie does. Like, it delivers some memorable stuff in ways that I maybe take a little bit of issue with, but like that image is going to stick in my head of like her looking down between her legs and seeing this protrusion coming from inside that beanbag. That's a really disturbing visual image that I thought was really well done. So,
And really, that's why I think overall, as you said earlier, this is something that gives me a lot of hope for Green's future as a filmmaker, because I do think he's got something. I don't think it all coalesces in this one film perfectly at all. But yeah. I think that there's enough little hints and you know, flavors and spices that, you know, I've certainly seen, you know, plenty of sauceless, to use a 2025 term, you know, filmmakers and go, I don't need to see another movie by this person because they just clearly don't have anything interesting to say. And so, yeah, there's if anything, like you said, it's the ambition that's very commendable, and also a little bit of its downfall, because it just is trying to do quite a lot, and it doesn't quite know how to bring all of it together in a satisfying, everybody can sort of look at it and go, yes, I understand you now way. But, but yeah, there's stuff that won't leave you.
Yeah. Okay. So any closing thoughts on the movie? Anything you wanted to shout out or mention that we didn't talk about yet?
Yeah. Well, I think we kind of, you know, glided around it and certainly mentioned up top the songs. But I think that if you are ever a fan of John Malkovich, and who isn't, you want to see this just for him. I mean, I think that, you know, as soon as you hear John Malkovich is a reclusive pop star, you're already kind of in the tank a little bit. And then,
yeah, it's a great premise.
Yeah, as much as that premise promises, it delivers in terms of his performance. I think that it's just great to see him having such a ball with this type of character, and, you know, how unlikely it is, you know, that him of all people are going to be this reclusive pop star figure. And it's just that all of that involving him was delight.
Yeah. Okay. So real quick, before we take a break and then go into your interview, Mark Anthony says something in your discussion that really interested me. People will hear it in just a minute, but he says that somebody read the movie as an anti-journalist film. And I thought that was interesting because, as you said in your written version of this interview that people can read at slashfilm.com, he worked at GQ for a bunch of years. He was a journalist before he made this film. And I think several characters in this movie are anti-journalists, or at least have like utter disdain for journalists. Like, there's obviously Moretti has full-on contempt for them. That's kind of the one of the big reveals, is that he pulls all these people into this resort or this isolated place because, as you said earlier, he has beef with them. But there's also this puppet show where journalists are portrayed as rats. And I was just curious what you made of like the notion of journalism, I guess, in this movie.
Oh, sure. No, I, you know, obviously there's a way that you can read this movie as having anti-journalist, you know, sentiments or tendencies, but that's only if you believe that, you know, this person making the movie, Mark Anthony Green, is a fully fledged, you know, artist type who never worked as a journalist. But once you know that he worked as a journalist, I think it has much more of that inside baseball kind of, you know, what's an expression they use, like, that people have used, like the best hits or the best snipes, you know, come from inside the house or something, where it's like, you know, the more knowledge you have of how a industry works, the better you can criticize it and that sort of thing. And yeah, that Billie Holiday rat puppet show sequence is pretty another image that's not going to leave, because of how it's presented, but also when it's presented, and the fact that, you know, it feels like it comes at a point in the movie where in other movies might be getting a bigger reveal of like, here's why we did all this, you know? And it's like, oh, it's really because you were mad about the way that Billie Holiday was treated, or, you know, but you know, that's all part and parcel of Moretti's, you know, grand design and interest and, you know, his themes in the world of, you know, art and humanity and all that. So I think that, yeah, I think that once you have a little bit of that background of knowing that Green has a background in journalism, and certainly what his comments in my interview with him, you know, corroborate his respect for the job, it's less about, oh, journalists are evil people who are just out to get all of us great artists. And it's more, you know, the unfortunate trappings of the way that the world works, the way that capitalism works, the way that, you know, media works, in terms of, we shouldn't be enemies, but these systems that, you know, have existed forever are making us that. And I never got in, even, you know, even the fact that essentially Ariel is a patsy character, you know, she is presented for most of the movie as the heroine. And really, you know, one of the reveals at the end is that, oops, you know, it was all a dupe. She was really intended to do that and really intended to get away and all that. It doesn't, for me, doesn't diminish her enough to say, oh, it's actually all a joke on us journalists. It's more, you know, the kind of unfortunate reality that all of us working in this profession can easily be duped by the corporations that, you know, are behind everything and everything like that, you know?
Yeah. And even the subjects to some degree, you know, it's like about manipulation in some way. And like, I think he has sympathy for the Ariel character at the end. Like, yes, she is writing this book because she has ambition and she wants to make something of herself. And she lays out her plan at the beginning of the movie of like, I want to become famous as a writer, basically, because I want people to take what I have to say seriously. And like, you could kind of roll your eyes at that a little bit if you want to, but I think he comes with that mentality, that stance from an honest place, or at least he does as the writer, and I think she does as a character. And then, yeah, when you get to the end and you realize like she has accomplished her dream in some ways, but it's really been in service of the villain of the movie, I think he feels like that's a gut punch moment, or at least that's how I read it to be. So,
you know, just speaking with you now about the movie, it coalesced a idea in my mind about it, which is that I think the reason why this movie isn't ultimately anti-journalist, you know, it wants to be very murky and nuanced about the whole, you know, topic of all of it included. And of course, it's such a huge topic that you can't possibly hope to sum it all up. But I think that Green, for me, equates journalists with artists in a way that I think they should be, because most people don't. Most people think of journalism as anti-art. You know, they think of it as something that's there to criticize only, that's there to report only, that's there to, you know, take what these geniuses in the world are doing and, you know, somehow reduce it to something, you know, either lesser than or manageable or what have you. And I think that what Green understands is that so many of us, especially in the entertainment journalism space, but I think also in just regular, you know, news reporting or you know, foreign correspondence, whatever you want to say, you know, there is an art to doing good journalism. And I think that as journalism continues to dwindle, I think we're seeing that, you know, in spades. So, yeah, I think that Green correctly equates, you know, these people that we're kind of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, totally. Okay, so let's take a quick break and then we'll get back into your interview with writer-director Mark Anthony Green.
When it comes to fungicides, there's only one way to spell yield. N-E-O. Miravis Neo is the 2024 number one retailer recommended corn fungicide for a reason. It dominates spots, rots, blights, and stress to out-yield competitive brands like Veltima. And there's 6 years of university data to prove it. Ask your Syngenta retailer about using Miravis Neo for more yield more often. Based on 2024 Stratus Retailer Efficacy Study. Always read and follow label instructions.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQBAR products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Bill, what up, baby?
Hey, what's up, Mark?
How you feeling?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling really good. We're like kind of in theaters today.
Yeah. Yeah, it's starting tonight-ish.
Yeah, tonight-ish.
So awesome.
I feel good.
Awesome. Well, congratulations on the movie, man. It's so cool to see. And I kind of want to start at the end because, not to give away spoilers, of course, but I just wanted to say how enamored I am with the way that you structured this script and this film. I love an ending that recontextualizes everything I've seen previously. I was wondering if there was any movies or filmmakers that inspired you to make such a bold choice. And was it something you had any pushback on while making it, or... You know, was there something you were able to sort of sell to folks easily, or?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's, in filmmaking process, there's a healthy amount of pushback throughout it all, through kind of every decision. So I don't think there was an unhealthy amount of pushback, especially on the ending. I'm trying to think of a film... You know, somebody asked me the other day what was the first horror film that I watched.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing all these interviews, you know, there's like an enormous self-reflection process that
sure.
I did not expect. It's Bill, brother in Christ, it has been quite the experience. The first horror film I ever watched was Thriller. And it scared me. And I was a kid. And then... My grandfather, great-grandfather took us to a baseball game and there was a full moon and I was like afraid at the game. and so I've been thinking about Thriller a lot, and the moment when he looks back and he's still got the demon in him or whatever it is with the eyes and the iconic thing, I think that was like the first time I ever saw... like a film end, but not like have a satisfying ending, but there was more to the story, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
And I think the ending of Opus, my goal is that I hope that it's very satisfying, but I want you to ask certain questions. And if I gave the answers, or if it felt like the story came to like an end, like a screeching halt, I don't think that you ask those questions. So
yeah.
It's a really fine line of you know, it's a dance. But the ending is one of the things I'm the most proud of, and it does seem like it's a thing that people. Positively are responding to, which has made me super happy. All the arguments and fights and writing and editing was well worth it.
Absolutely. Well, as I said, it's one of my favorite elements of the movie. Another aspect that I was really curious about is what made you want to set the film in, or, you know, regarding the music industry specifically. And I wondered, was it partially because of the rise of, you know, stan culture in the present day, or the cult-like power that rock stars of the past, you know, used to hold over their fans? Was it some combination of the two? What inspired you to go that direction?
It's a little bit of both of those points, which are really smart points. But mostly, I wanted to pick something where it felt good.
Mm.
So, like, part of my issue with tribalism, which is a thing that spans well past entertainment, is that it's so divisive, right? And so if I've never met you, Bill, you've never met me. Where are you from?
All over, but I was born in Massachusetts, moved to Michigan when I was 10, you know?
So let's say Michigan,
yeah.
Raised, you know, and I'm from the Midwest. Like, we may not have, we might be sitting next to each other in a movie theater. I'm probably older than you, so we're different ages from different places, and we both love horror films. But outside of that, like, we're just strangers. We're strangers in experience. We're And I wanted to make something that it felt like if we bobbed our heads together and we looked away at the same time, then maybe we would, through this very fun, wild ride experience, we would not be so reticent to have a conversation with one another, to ask a question and for you to have a different answer than me, and for me to not be just repulsed by you because we went through this experience. And I felt like, you know, making the film as fun as possible is the most effective way to hopefully achieve this goal. And so that's why I chose pop music, and which created the issue of having to actually create pop music, which is an expensive, very difficult endeavor. But Niall and Dream and John and everybody, all the engineers and the crazy folks at A24 that let me do this, you know, I the songs are so good, and that experience, I think, is elevated to a very fun place because of it.
Mm. And of course, I was going to ask about that, so I love that you brought it up, because I consider Opus to be amongst, I don't know how rare it is, but definitely a core group, a good group of films about fictional pop stars or fictional bands where the songs are legitimately as good as they have to be to sell that this is a major pop star in this fictional world. And you spoke a little bit about it already, but I was wondering how hard of a process or how long of a process was it, or was it a quick process, conversely, in terms of getting those songs right? Because it's not just, you know, they have to sound good, they have to be legitimately good, all that. But also, you know, I'm thinking, of course, the listening party scene, you know, that scene works on several levels once you know everything that's going on. So was there so much of that consideration when they were going into the songwriting too, or?
Ah, it's so hard. It's one of the hardest things in making this film.
Okay.
Because, you know, you have no money. So you got to convince people that make millions and millions of dollars to do this for no money. And Dream and Niall were working with Beyonce at the time. So I had to take time away from Beyonce. Beyonce, if you're reading this, I'm very sorry. And so that in itself, that's just to get them to say they'll try, is like damn near impossible. And then you have to get them to make these songs in your deadline. And it, you know, also to let them, they have to take direction. You got to send songs back that they love and be like, no, I, you know, it needs to do this, or it has to fit within the story. Because at the end of the day, the story is king. You know, I work, that's my boss, right? And then if you can do all of that, which is damn near impossible, you got to get the actor to go in. And for the way I shot it, to do it before the movie, before pre-production, and to go in and to sing these songs, and they have to do it. And it was really important to me that the first thing John do as Moretti was the music. And so all of these things, all of these little baby miracles have to happen in order for you to pull this off. And they did. And we did, and you know, it's one of the most ambitious things about the film, but I just am so deeply grateful for everybody, and I listen to the songs constantly still, you know.
Absolutely. So. Well, you know, I don't know how they think, but I hope that people keep these in contention or in their minds for next year's awards ceremonies, because I think there should be some best songs. So going in a different direction here, you know, one of the other things that I really enjoyed and you know, was taken with about the movie was the fact that the Levelists themselves, you know, the cult in the film, really did seem to have a lot of specificity to their look, to their behavior, to their practices. So how did you go about that process in terms of drilling them down? Did you do a lot of research into cults, or was it more just analogies of like, I kind of know the vibe I'm going for, but let me try and find their look through a different way? How did you come to that?
No, I mean, I did. I would argue that, well, not I would argue, but I would say that the cult research was the least enjoyable part of making this film. I'm not a huge, you know, you study cults, and this was 2020, so I had entirely too much time to do the, like, very, very deep, all-consuming dive, and I did it for months. And what I charged myself with was being able to, I wrote a 350-page a Bible, so to speak, the Meditations of Lovell. So like I wanted to make sure that I knew what this religion believed and their practices, their dogmas, how that can be used to exploit somebody, what about them is desirable, whatever similarities that they have to other cults or religions, and the differences in, you know, why that would be attractive to Moretti. And it's just a you see how so many people's lives have been ruined by some of these bad actors. You also see why religion is still such a dominant force in the human experience, and how, you know, statistically, humanity has never been less religious than it is today. So we are becoming less and less religious as a species. And I think part of my, you know, thesis is I think we're replacing the human want to belong to something bigger than ourselves. I mean, the rise of tribalism is because of that. There's kind of nothing more human than to want to be part of something that's bigger than just being human. And I think that that has made us extremely vulnerable as a society. And where are you at, Bill?
LA.
LA, okay. Yeah, so, you know, it's like, I think this is a global pandemic. Tribalism. But I also felt like the religion substitute that felt like a very visceral, fun thing to explore. And yeah, so I did.
I love that you also mentioned that book, because I remember you were discussing that at Sundance. I was lucky enough to be at that premiere. And right away, as soon as you mentioned it then and as you mentioned it now, I have to ask, will any of us ever get to see that book?
No. I would never want, you know, I wrote it with the exploitable parts and the certain ceremonious things that are could be violent, and I love movies, especially horror movies, for the escapism of it. I'm sure you do too, right? Like we love these films, slasher films. What was the one that came out last year? A Violent Nature.
In a Violent Nature, yeah.
Yeah, like. I saw that full theater, and we had so much fun. No part of me wants any part of that to ever be real. And I think one of, like, if not the biggest power in movies is that, is the fantastical fantasy element of them. And so I think as a human, I have there's like a responsibility. There might be four people that read that and think, man, what a smart dedicated filmmaker he was. Look at all this work he put into it. But if even one person got half of a bad idea from reading it, I would be heartbroken. So, you know, whatever good could come from it, the risk of the bad is just not really worth it for me.
No, that's absolutely a very sober point. So I'm glad you mentioned that. Another aspect that I really wanted to talk about with you is basically the character of Ariel. I mean, not only is Io, you know, fantastic as always, but I was really taken with, and of course, you know, learning that you were slash are a journalist yourself. As a journalist, I was like, you know, yes, journalist hero again.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, there used to be quite a few films made with the journalist hero or protagonist. And yeah. I feel like we haven't had one since, you know, other than like Superman or Lois Lane and all that. I don't know, Spotlight from 2015.
Yeah.
So I would love to hear about you guys conceiving that character, how she works with like the final girl tropes and working with Io.
Working with Io is a dream. She's so talented, so funny. She's my like ideal protagonist, this beautiful black woman. She's also from Massachusetts. I was from Boston. And so that's like a dream, you know, that's a dream day at the office for anybody if you get the chance to work with her. For me, the journalism, like, I am deeply pro journalists and pro media. And I thought, you know, Ariel's character, from the way, one of my favorite moments in the film is when she's walking through the kind of bullpen in the beginning.
Mm.
You see so much of her swagger. She looks kind of sad because she's frustrated.
Mm.
But she's totally in her own skin. And, you know, it's such a hard job being a journalist, and often a thankless job.
Mm.
And this film, I think what it does, it's funny, it bummed me out. There was a critic who read it as anti-journalism. And, you know, it's not my job to tell somebody how to interpret this film.
Mm.
It's, if anything, it's just my job to listen. But Mark Anthony, the person, for sure just doesn't think that or feel that in any way, shape, or form. I probably did that job for 13 years.
Yeah.
I think what Opus does to me is it highlights how difficult, you know, Bill, your job is. You, in reporting a story, a lot of times you are going, you know, you're going to follow the truth. And right now, without saying any names, the people who are providing us the quote unquote truth are some of the most corrupt people ever. And so it becomes more and more and more difficult to decipher if the truth that you're, a truth that you're putting out into the world is the truth. And as somebody who sat in that seat, and you as somebody that sits in that seat right now, it's a bit like, I don't think that your job has ever been more difficult. And so I think every journalist is a fucking hero. Even the ones that don't like my film, even the ones that, you know, they might report or have opinions about the world that I really disagree with, but that's what they believe and they tell the truth.
Mm.
I think that it's one of the most important institutions that we have. I'm stoked and honored to like add Ariel in the cinematic pantheon of journalists and put her up there with Zodiac and Spotlight, but also like Nightcrawler.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Which is like an incredible film. And obviously that dude is kind of like shows the very rare, awful bad actor, in, you know, local, salacious, I don't know what to even call what, Jake Gyllenhaal does in that film. I just know that I love that movie. But yeah, but I'm honored to put her in that. And, yeah.
Awesome. Well, just to wrap up, I'm again, so impressed with, your work, yourself as a person, the film. I mean, you clearly have so much passion and knowledge and intelligence. And unfortunately, it is your first film and you're entering cinema at a time which I personally feel is precarious for the entire industry.
Yeah.
What is it to you? Where do you stand in terms of your inspiration, in terms of making films, in terms of cinema as a medium? What inspires you to keep going?
You know, one, I don't feel like I have a choice.
Mm.
Here's the problem is there's an assumption. Well, there's this assumption that directors make films for money, which is not true. Directors make films for fame or any of the things that come with, also not true.
Mm.
Like, it is the hardest one of the hardest creative jobs on the planet. And you have to really want to do this.
Mm.
And the problem is that if you do it, you know that nothing in the world is going to make you feel that way. I made a short film 8 years ago and I went into debt making it.
Mm.
Like kind of like bad debt, like not like cute. Oh, this is a funny story. Like I went into debt making that movie.
Yeah.
And never had a better time. I was never more stressed out. I got my first gray hair, and you know, fell out with people that I've known forever. Never had a better time. I never felt like making Opus was an option. I do not feel like making my next film is an option. I feel like it is a devotion, and I am deeply devoted to becoming the best filmmaker that I can be. And if I spend the rest of my life trying to make movies, trying to make them in a way that is deeply personal, with integrity and thoughtful and original, and then I die, I know that I will be happy and satisfied. And so whatever the industry does, which I hope it all gets figured out, and I hope that every director is compensated and loved and all of the things, but whether that happens or doesn't happen, my ass will be trying to get to set to make movies. And there's something liberating about the prison of that. There's something deeply liberating about not feeling like I have a choice.
Mm.
But I'm one of the lucky people that found why I think I was put on this planet. And I just need to focus on that. I just need to focus on getting better at that. I just need to focus on doing that as much and as thoughtfully and as impactfully as possible. And, you know, that's where my head and my heart is. And as a movie lover, which we share, I just think that the boogeyman will always lose and that film will never die. And that we will figure this shit the fuck out.
There's the poster right there. Oh, you know? Man, Mark, it has been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I think
likewise,
I have to let you go.
Bro, likewise. I hope we meet in person.
Yeah.
Yeah, we gotta figure that out. I didn't, you know, people being in LA, I'm like, oh, we could have sat down. But yeah, but if I don't see you before then, I'll see you on the next one, and I'm stoked to read the piece. And again, I'm a fan of your writing and what you guys do there. So, you know.
Well, likewise, man. Thank you. And yeah, if you're ever in LA, you ever see me, feel free to come up and say hi. I've had people I've interviewed do that, and I'm always happy to do that. So
yeah, likewise, bro.
Thank you, man. Good luck with the movie. Have a great opening.
Yeah, thank you. Later.
Bye-bye.
Okay, that is going to do it for today's episode. Just real quick, Bill, that was a great interview. Like, I really enjoyed listening to that. I think that's one of the best ones you've done in a long time. And, like, he is such an interesting guy, and it seems like he has so many big ideas. And, you know, we talked about this already, but, like, throwing those all into one movie maybe didn't quite work out the way that everyone would have hoped to its fullest extent in this film. But I hope he doesn't necessarily dial back the ambition going forward, because I think he's going to get that mixture exactly right in the future. It just feels like he's the kind of guy who could definitely pull off something really, really special moving forward. So, shout out to him.
Yeah, no, he didn't come off like a person who is only jumping into the industry just because, I'm so interested in just doing multiple verticals or whatever, you know. You know, he really obviously has a passion for it. And so I think that, you know, that's, what is that old G.I. Joe thing? Passion's half the battle, right? To paraphrase that.
Yes, exactly. All right. Well, you can find more about Opus, including Bill's full review of the movie, at slashfilm.com. I will link to that in the show notes. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on Apple, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and mailbag topics to us at bpearson@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Don't forget to take a minute to rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. That really helps us out a lot. Tell your friends about the show any way you can. Thank you so much for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
When it comes to fungicides, there's only one way to spell yield. N-E-O. Miravis Neo is the 2024 number one retailer recommended corn fungicide for a reason. It dominates spots, rots, blights, and stress to out-yield competitive brands like Veltima. And there's 6 years of university data to prove it. Ask your Syngenta retailer about using Miravis Neo for more yield more often. Based on 2024 Stratus Retailer Efficacy Study. Always read and follow label instructions.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter. Hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.